He was shocked to hear the words leave his mouth. He was even more shocked when she said yes. Chapter 30. Nikolai. They waited beneath a flat gray sky. It might have been dawn, it might have been dusk. Magical things happened at the in-between times. Morozova's sacred amplifiers had appeared at twilight. The stag, the sea whip, the firebird. Perhaps the saints were the same. Nikolai stood on the sands, flanked by Zoya and Yuri above the spot where warrior priests had once come to be transformed, where the Darkling had torn the world open and created the fold, and where, years later, he had finally been defeated. If there was power in this place, Nikolai could only hope that it was friendly and that it would help to destroy the remnants of the curse the Darkling had left behind. Elisaveta's gown of roses bloomed dark red around her, a high collar of blossoms and buds framing her face as her bees hummed in her hair. Grigori's massive body folded and unfolded in a shifting mass of limbs. Nikolai wondered what form he would choose for his brief mortal life. Juris was nowhere to be seen. "The dragon couldn't be bothered to attend," he whispered to Zoya. "He wants this more than anyone," she said, and glanced up at the black stone of his spire in the distance. "I have no doubt he's watching." Elisaveta nodded at both of them as her insects buzzed and clicked. "Are you ready, my king?" she asked Nikolai. "We cannot entertain the possibility of failure."
"A shame," Nikolai murmured. "My failures are so entertaining."
He raised his voice and said, "I'm ready." Yuri stood beside Zoya, his whole body vibrating with tension or fervor. In his shaking hands, he held the pages of text he had continued to translate without Tolia's help. Elisaveta had insisted he remain with Nikolai and recite the ceremony. "Is that entirely necessary?" Zoya had demanded.
"The words are sacred," Elisaveta had said. "They should be spoken as they once were. Yuri has his role to play in this, too."
The monk pressed the pages to his chest now. His eyes looked wide and startled behind the lenses of his spectacles.
I find I do not know what to pray for."
Nikolai gave his shoulder an encouraging squeeze.
"Then pray for Ravka."
The monk nodded.
"You are a good man. I can have faith in the Starless One and have faith in that too."
"Thank you," said Nikolai. He wasn't going to enjoy disappointing Yuri, but whether Nikolai lived or died this day, there would be no sainthood for the Darkling. He would have to find some other way to appease the monk. Yuri was a boy in search of a cause, and that at least was something Nikolai could understand. He turned to Zoya.
"You have the order. If the monster takes me."
"I know what to do."
"You needn't sound quite so eager."
To his surprise, Zoya seized his hand.
"Come back," she said. "Promise you'll come back to us."
Because he was most likely about to die, he let himself cup his hand briefly to her extraordinary face. Her skin felt cool against his fingers.
"Of course I'll come back," he said. "I don't trust anyone else to deliver my eulogy."
A smile curled her lips.
"You've written it already?"
"It's very good. You'd be surprised how many synonyms there are for handsome."
Zoya closed her eyes. She turned her face, letting her cheek rest against his palm.
"Nikolai."
The hum of Elisaveta's insects rose.
"It's time," she said, and lifted her hands. "Nikolai Lantsov, prepare yourself."
Zoya released his hand and stepped away. He desperately wanted to pull her back into his arms and ask her what she'd intended to say.
"This is not a goodbye," he told himself.
But it certainly felt like one. Thunder rumbled over the gray sky. A moment later, Nikolai realized it wasn't coming from above, but from below. The ground began to tremble, and a sound like distant hoofbeats rose from somewhere deep within the earth. It grew, an oncoming stampede that shook the sands. Elisaveta grimaced, perspiration gleaming on her brow. She loosed a shout, and the thornwood burst from the sand. The stalks surrounded Nikolai and Zoya, twining and twisting, the thicket growing up around them as if woven on an invisible loom. Yuri began to chant.
"Have you never wondered at the power of the woods?" asked Elisaveta, her face glowing as she drove the brambles higher. "The magic at the heart of so many stories, the prick of a thorn, the magic a single rose can carry. These trees are older than anything else in the world, sprung from the first making. Before man and animal and anything else, they are old as the stars, and they belong to me."
Gold seemed to drip from the thornwood stalks, pooling at the bases of their trunks, then flowing in sinuous rivers toward Zoya. The sap formed a sphere around her, hardening into amber. Nikolai saw her press her hands into the sphere's sides as liquid began to rise over her ankles. The stalks around them creaked, twining against each other, the sound merging with the jagged syllables of ancient Ravkin. "Save her." The impulse was always the same, one that somehow both he and the dark thing within him could agree upon. Maybe because the darkling had once valued Zoya and fostered her power, but Nikolai had known it would not be difficult to call the beast this time. It had been waiting, barely leashed, gnashing its teeth.
"Draw your sword, my king," cried Elisaveta.
Nikolai drew the saber at his side and felt the monster rise.
"Remember who you are." Claws shot from his hands, and he roared as his wings burst from his back.
The demon's hunger filled him, the desire to rend flesh, to feed, stronger than it had ever been. Before Nikolai could succumb and lose all sense, he slashed his sword through the nearest branch, slicing a thorn free of its stalk. It was nearly as long as his saber. He sheathed his blade and took the thorn in his taloned hands. Could he really do this? Could he really drive it into his own heart? Both of their hearts. Slay the monster. Free himself. He heard the creature scream as if understanding his intent.
"Only one of us will survive this," Nikolai vowed. "It is time you met the will of a king."
"What king?" said a dark voice within him.
"It is a bastard I have come to kill."
Was it his hand that held the thorn blade? Or was it the monster that kept the point poised above his heart?
"Nikolai nothing," said the voice. "Liar, fraud, heir to no one, pretender to the throne. I see who you are."
But Nikolai knew those cruelties. He'd borne them his whole life.
"It takes more than blood to make a king. Tell me what it takes to rule," the thing said in that taunting voice. "Courage, valor, love for the people." "All of that."
Nikolai strengthened his grip. He could feel the weight of the thorn in his palm.
"And a solid sense of style." "But the people don't love you, bastard. Despite your constant striving."
The voice sounded different now. Cool, familiar, smooth as glass.
"How long have you been begging for their love? Little Nikolai Lansoff, playing the clown for his mother, the sycophant for his father, the handsome courtier for Alina. She was an orphan, a peasant, and even she didn't want you. And yet, you continue pleading for scraps, like the commoner you are." Nikolai managed to laugh, but it did not come easy.
"I've met enough commoners and enough kings to not take that as an insult."
"What do you think they saw in you to make you so unworthy? All of those medals earned, your fleet of ships, your heroic deeds, your earnest reforms. You know it will never be enough. Some children are born unlovable. Their mothers will not suckle them. They are left to die in the forest. And here you are, come to weep your last, alone in the thornwood.
I'm not alone.
He had Zoya, even Yuri for that matter, and Grigori and Elisaveta watching over them.
I have your delightful company.
Now the dark voice laughed, low and long, mirth overflowing in a black tide.
Go ahead and do it then. Drive the thorn into your chest. Do you really think it will matter? Do you really think anything can make you the man you were before?
Before the war, before the Darkling had set this curse upon him, before Vasily's murder, the revelation of his father's crimes, the ambush at the spinning wheel, the countless battles that had cost so many lives.
How do you think I was able to take hold of your heart and burrow so deeply? You gave me fertile soil, and so I took root. You will never be what you were. The rot has spread too far.
That's a lie. Elisaveta had warned Nikolai that the demon would try to trick him. So why did the words ring true?
Oh, you make a good show of it. Compromise, patience, an endless performance of good works to prove you are still the confident prince, the brazen privateer, whole and happy and unafraid. All that work to hide the demon. Why?
The people. The people clung to superstition. They feared the strange. Ravka could not afford another disruption. Another weak king.
Another weak king.
The voice was knowing, almost pitying.
You said it yourself.
I am not my father.
Of course not. You have no father. I'll tell you why you hide the demon. Why you cloak yourself in compromise and diplomacy and dribbling, desperate charm. It is because you know that if they saw you truly, they would turn away. They would see the nightmares that wake you, the doubts that plague you. They would know how very weak you are, and they would turn their backs. Use the thorn. Drive me out. You will still be a broken man, demon or not.
Was this the real fear that had chased him all these long months? That he would find no cure because the disease was not the demon? That the darkness inside him did not belong to something else, but to him alone? He had been a fool. What he'd endured in the war, the choices he'd made, the lives he had ended with bullets and blades and bombs, there was no magic that could burn that away. He'd been human, then. He'd had no demon to blame. He might purge the monster from his body, but the mess of shame and regret would remain. And what would happen when the fighting started up again? The thought made him impossibly weary. The war was supposed to be over. The demon's laughter rolled over him.
Not for you, said the voice. Not for Ravka. Not ever.
Nikolai knew he had come here with a purpose. Drive the monster out. Save his country. Save himself. But those were not necessarily the same thing. He could not go back. He could not heal himself. He could not take back the part of him that had been lost. So how was he to lead?
Lay down the thorn.
The thorn. Nikolai could no longer feel it in his hand.
Lay down the thorn. Not every day can end in victory. Not every soldier can be saved. This country won't survive a broken king.
Nikolai had always understood that he and Ravka were the same. He just hadn't understood how. He was not the crying child, or even the drowning man. He was the forever soldier, eternally at war,
unable to ever lay down his arms and heal.
Lay down the thorn, boy king. Haven't you earned a bit of rest? Aren't you tired? He was. Saints, he was.
He thought he had grown used to his scars, but he had never grasped how much of his will it would take to hide them. He had fought and sacrificed and bled. He had gone long days without rest and long nights without comfort, all for Ravka, all for an ideal he would never attain and a country that would never care.
A bit of peace, whispered the demon. You have the right.
The right to wash his hands of this endless struggle and stop pretending he was somehow better than his father, more worthy than his brother. He was owed that much, wasn't he?
Yes, crooned the demon. I will see Ravka safe to shore.
Zoya would never forgive him, but Zoya would keep marching on, with losses and wounds of her own. Zoya would not rest.
Steel is earned, your highness, she had said, his ruthless general.
What had he earned? What was he owed? What was his by right? He knew what Zoya would say.
You are owed nothing. Steel is earned. Remember who you are. Bastard, hissed the demon.
I am Nikolai Lansov. I have no right to my name.
Pretender, howled the dark voice.
I am Nikolai Lansov. I have no right to my crown. But each day he might endeavor to earn it. If he dared continue on with this wound in his heart, if he dared to be the man he was, instead of praying to return to the man he'd once been. Maybe everything the monster said was true. All Nikolai had done or would do for his people might never be enough. A part of him might always remain beyond repair. He might never be a truly noble man or a truly worthy king. In the end, he might be nothing more than a good head of hair and a gift for delusion. But he knew this much. He would not rest until his country could too. And he would never, ever turn his back on a wounded man, even if that man was him.
Nikolai nothing, snarled the demon. Ravka will never be yours.
Perhaps not. But if you loved a thing, the work was never done.
Remember who you are.
Nikolai knew. He was a king who had only begun to make mistakes. He was a soldier for whom the war would never be over. He was a bastard left alone in the woods, and he was not afraid to die this day. He seized the thorn and drove it into his heart. The monster shrieked, but Nikolai felt no pain at all, just heat as if a blaze had ignited in his chest. For a second he thought he might be dead, but when he opened his eyes, the world remained. The thornwood, the twilight sky, the golden sphere. He had a brief moment to wonder why Elisaveta hadn't freed Zoya yet, and then he saw the monster. It was a shape of pure shadow that hovered in front of him as if suspended in a mirror. Its wings beat gently at the air. In the place where the creature's heart would be, a slender shard of light glowed. The thorn. So this was the demon. The dark thing that had driven him, played with him, stolen his will.
I am the monster, and the monster is me.
They were not as separate as he would have liked to pretend, but he remembered Elisaveta's words. Only one of you will survive. It was time to slay the demon and put an end to this. He reached for his sword. But he could not move his arms, could not move his legs. The thornwood had grabbed hold of him, its stalks clinging tightly to his limbs, its spikes digging into his flesh. Sap was still filling the golden sphere around Zoya despite the fact that he'd already called the monster. She was shouting and pounding her fists against its sides. Something was very wrong.
He screamed as a sudden searing bolt of pain shot through his hand. He looked to his left and saw a thorn impaling him through the palm. Another followed through his right hand and then each of his legs.
I know the pain is bad, said Elisaveta as she drifted through the thicket, but the thorns will keep you from forcing the darkness to recede.
What is this? Nikolai panted. Pain speared through him as he tried to break free.
I had hoped you might simply let the monster overtake you, that your demon would win. It would have made all of this easier.
Nikolai's mind struggled to make sense of what Elisaveta was saying.
You're a prisoner here, Nikolai said. After all this, you cannot mean to stay.
Certainly not. The boundaries of the fold will remain intact, and here my brethren will be held captive still. But I will be free, because I will be bound to him.
Nikolai did not need to ask who she meant.
The Darkling.
She nodded once.
The true king of Ravka. His spirit lived on with his power. It is only in need of a vessel.
The thicket parted, and Nikolai saw a pale body borne atop a bier of branches.
It cannot be.
He had stood on the shores of the fold and watched the Darkling burn, and yet here his body was, whole and uncorrupted. It had to be some kind of illusion, or a brilliant facsimile. Yori stood beside the bier, the pages of liturgical Ravkin discarded. He wore a robe of black roses emblazoned with the sun in eclipse.
Forgive me,
he said, his face contrite.
I wish it did not have to be so. I wish you could both survive this day. But the Starless One is Ravka's greatest hope. He must return.
I find I do not know what to pray for.
Go on, Yori, Elisaveta said. This honor is yours.
Nikolai remembered Yori babbling when they had first come to the saint's fold.
All is as was promised.
He thought of the curling vine Elisaveta had so soothingly laid across Yori's shoulders. She hadn't been trying to comfort him. She'd been afraid of what else he might say.
Yori has his role to play in this, too.
He'd said the Darkling had come to him in a vision. Yori approached the shadow beast and reached for the glowing shard wedged within its heart. Nikolai knew with sudden surety that if he pulled the thorn from the monster's chest first, it would be an end to everything.
Don't, Yori!
He did not like the pleading in his voice. It did not become a king.
Don't do this! You are a good man, said Yori. But Ravka needs more than a man.
He reached up and grabbed the thorn.
No, Nikolai would not allow it.
He had opened the door. It was time to walk through. The monster was not the Darkling, not yet. It was something else still. Something that longed for its own life, that had its own appetites, that he had lived with for 3 years.
Why do you hide the demon?
Because it was angry, hungry, full of broken animal longing, and though Nikolai might not like it, those things were all a part of him still. Like calls to like. He had fought the demon. Now he would feed it. Nikolai shut his eyes and did what that dark voice had told him to do. He let go of the perfect prince, the good king. He reached for all the wounded, shameful things he'd been so sure he had to hide. In this moment, he was not kind, or merciful, or just. He was a monster. He left his mortal body behind. When Nikolai opened his eyes, he was looking at Yori from a different angle, close enough to see the smudge on his glasses, the wiry hairs of his scrabbly beard. Nikolai felt his wings beat the air. Felt his demon heart race. He released a snarl and launched himself at the monk. Chapter 31. Nina. Their timing had to be precise.
The Well Mother and her Spring Maidens would see to their charges on the factory ward and return sometime in the hours after midnight. Nina did not want to risk crossing paths with them, but she also needed to make sure they would have time to retrieve the girls, set the explosives, and get through the checkpoint on the road leading into town. If the guards at the checkpoint got a sign that something was wrong at the factory, they might well decide to investigate the vehicles passing through. And if that happened, there would be nowhere to hide. 2 hours before dawn, Hannah bound her breasts and pulled a pinafore over one of her stolen military uniforms. She kept a shawl wrapped around her head. She and Nina slipped out through the kitchens and went to meet Leonie and Adric at the abandoned tanning shed, where they were waiting with the enclosed wagon they'd secured. They helped Adric into his uniform and stuffed his loose sleeve with cotton batting, pinning the end into his pocket to disguise his missing hand. Hannah tucked her pinafore away and took the driver's seat with Adric beside her, while Nina and Leonie, both attired as spring maidens, climbed into the bag. They were silent as they rode through the dark. Nina had laced her sleeves with bone shards, and she reached out to them now with her power, craving the peace they provided. She understood the risks she had asked the people around her to take, the danger she was putting them all in. When they rolled to a stop, Nina knew they'd reached the checkpoint at the base of the hill. She peered through the slats and saw Hannah flash the order they'd forged to the man at the guardhouse. It bore Broom's stolen seal. Nina held her breath, waiting. A moment later, she heard a snap of the reins, and they were moving once more. The road leading to the eastern entrance was straight but rocky, and Nina felt her heart pounding with the hoofbeats of their horses as they made slow progress up the hill. There was no turning back now. She had lied not only to Hannah but to Adric and Leonie as well about what she intended to accomplish today. The idea had come to her during her long dinner with Jarl Broom. It might be madness. It might fail spectacularly. But Nina had started to wonder if they'd been trying to fix Fierda with the wrong tool. Finally, the horses slowed, and Nina heard the voices of the guards. The wagon halted again. They had arrived at the eastern entrance to the fort. The whispers in her mind rose, guiding her on. "Nina," they chorused. She shivered. The dead knew her name. "Justice," they demanded. She thought of the graves that surrounded this place, all the women and girls and children who had been lost here. "You will be the last," she promised. Matthias had once begged her to save some mercy for his country, and she had vowed she would. But the girls in that ward were Fjerdans. Their children were Fjerdans. They were citizens of Gafala, and Jella, and Kaerut. The people of this country needed to be reminded of that. The guards were looking over the order, taking their time. "Tell them to get moving," whispered Adric. "Said yet," Hannah barked. "Hurry up." She'd lowered the timbre of her voice, and for a moment she sounded chillingly like her father. "What's the rush?" asked one of the guards. "Why do you need to move the prisoners now?" "Not everyone knows about the work Commander Broom has authorized here," said Hannah, following the script Nina had laid out for her. "We got word the local governors are coming to the factory to investigate complaints about poisons in the river. We don't need more trouble." "Bureaucrats," grumbled the guard. "Probably just looking for another bribe." Another bribe? Did that mean local officials had been paid to look the other way about the fouling of the river? Or about the girls in the abandoned wing? A moment later, the gate creaked open. "Leave it that way," said Hannah. "Time is short." "Wait a minute," said the guard. He threw open the back doors of the wagon and peered at Leonie and Nina in their pinafores. "What are these two doing here?" "For Jell's sake, do you think I'm going to take care of a bunch of crying women and shitting infants?" said Hannah. "Maybe you'd like to come along and wipe their asses." Saint, she really was a natural. The guard looked utterly horrified. "No, thank you." He slammed the door shut, and in the next second they were rolling through the gate into what had once been the eastern loading dock for the factory. "Let's go," Adric said, herding them up to the big double doors. "That all took longer than it was supposed to." Leonie dripped acid onto the locks to the ward, and they fell with a hiss and a clang. Gently, Nina pushed the doors open.
They moved into the darkness, down the hall, toward the dim glow of a lantern. She could smell bodies, the tang of sour milk, soiled diapers, the old industrial smells of grease and coal. The ward was full of the muzzy sounds of sleep, soft snores, the moan of a woman turning in her bed. A girl in a thin shift lay awake near the lantern, eyes hollow, skinny arms cradling her baby like a giant pearl. When she saw Nina and Leonie, her face broke into a happy, hopeful smile.
"You're here early," she cried. "Do you have my dose?" "Where's my dose?" said another, rising from her blankets.
"Saints," muttered Adric as lanterns were lit along the row of beds, and the horror of the ward came into view. Adric looked sick. Leonie's eyes were full of tears. Hannah had clapped a hand over her mouth. She was shaking her head.
"Hannah," Nina murmured.
"No."
She shook her head harder.
"No, he didn't do this. He couldn't have. He must not have known."
A baby began to cry. The reality of the girl's need, of their clumsy bodies, their hopeful expressions, felt overwhelming. Why had Nina believed they could get away with any of this? But she had chosen this course, for all of them.
"Sylvie?"
Hannah said on a sob. Sylvie Winther, Nina remembered, one of the people Hannah had nursed in secret. The hollow-eyed girl looked up, but there was no recognition in her eyes. Hannah went to her side, but the girl shrank back, confused.
"It's me," said Hannah. "I..."
And then she remembered her uniform, her altered face.
I'm sorry.
"Come on," Nina said. "We need to move." From her pocket she drew the sedative Leonie had mixed. It was milky white, boiled from the stalks of Gerda plants instead of the leaves.
"That doesn't look like my dose,"
said the girl by the lantern, frowning. "It's something new," said Nina soothingly. "We're taking all of you to a new base."
"All of us?"
one of the girls asked.
"The babies too?"
"Yes."
"Does the new base have windows?"
asked Sylvie.
"Yes," said Hannah, her voice raw. "And fresh food and sea breezes. It will be a hard journey, but we'll make it as comfortable as possible."
At least that much was true. One by one, they offered the girls their doses and began to lead them to the cart. Adric consulted his watch.
"Get going."
He raised his arm and Nina's ears popped as he dropped the pressure in the factory to create an acoustic blanket and mask their movements. Nina knew the layout of the factory floor best, so she would take Leonie to set the explosives while Adric and Hannah finished loading the prisoners and their infants. She helped Leonie stack the makeshift bombs in a basket beneath a pile of soiled linen, and they crept deeper into the heart of the fort. It was blessedly silent. The day not yet beginning, and thanks to Adric, their footsteps made no sound to break the quiet. Nina dashed ahead to the main body of the factory and into the western wing, as close as she dared to the barracks and the kitchens. She didn't want to risk running into any patrols. She set the small explosives along the wall as she headed back, all of them connected by a long fuse. Nina had just planted the last of her bombs when she heard a cry. "Leonie." She raced back to the main hall on silent feet. As she entered, she heard voices and shrank up against a dusty vat, peering around it. Leonie stood with her back to Nina, arms raised. Jarl Broom had a pistol trained on her. Nina clung to the vat, staying as still as possible.
"Who sent you?" he demanded. "You will give me answers or I will bleed them out of you."
"You disgust me," Leonie said in Zemini.
Their voices had a strange, muffled quality. Did Broom hear it? Did he know Grisha power was at work? Slowly, Nina crept down the row of machinery. If she could get behind Broom, she could disarm him.
"I don't speak your ugly tongue," he said, "and I know you understand more than you pretend to."
Leonie smiled, the expression startling in its beauty.
"And you understand less than you will ever know."
"I knew you weren't just traitors. Where is your compatriot? And what about the guide, Mila Yonderstadt? Does she know your spies?"
You're so very bald, Leonie said, still in Zemini. That won't be the worst thing Meliandrstadt does to you.
Was she a part of this?
Broom growled in frustration.
How many girls? Leonie said, switching to clumsy Fjordan. How many did you hurt?
Those aren't women, Broom sneered. They're Grisha, and I'll be happy to give you your first dose myself. The might of Fjorda is about to descend on you.
He reached for a lever in the wall, and Nina knew an alarm was going to sound.
Wait! She shouted, unsure of what she intended.
And at that moment, Jarl Broom crumpled to the ground. Hanna stood behind him holding a wrench and breathing heavily.
He knew,
she said brokenly.
He knew.
Then she fell to her knees beside him and cradled his bleeding head.
Papa,
she said, tears sliding down her cheeks.
How could you?
Come on, said Nina. We have to get the girls and get out of here. Hanna ran a sleeve over her eyes.
We can't leave him to die.
You saw what he's responsible for.
What the government is responsible for, said Hanna. My father is a soldier. You said it yourself. This country made him this way.
Nina didn't know if she wanted to laugh or scream. Jarl Broom was the commander of the Druskella, the mind behind the torture of countless Grisha. He was not a soldier.
Save some mercy for my people.
We need to go, said Leonie. If we don't light the first fuse soon, the bombs won't go off in time, assuming they go off at all.
He is my father,
said Hanna, her eyes full of that fierce determination Nina loved so much.
I won't leave him.
Nina threw up her hands in exasperation. Fine, help me lift him. They hauled Broom's body down the hall and through the ward. The man was enormous, and Nina was tempted to drop him just for the satisfaction of it.
So Commander Broom did not leave town?
Asked Adric, letting his arm fall to his side. Nina's ears crackled, and sound bled back into the ward.
I guess he wanted to say goodbye,
she muttered, as they dragged him into the back of the wagon. The girls looked at him with vague interest. The sedative had definitely set in.
What about your sister? Said Hanna.
She's not here, Nina said. She must have been moved.
How can you be sure?
We need to go, insisted Nina. She hopped down and ran back to the ward to set the fuses. She lit the last of them and was about to join the others at the loading dock when a voice shouted,
Stop!
Nina turned. The well mother was racing down the ward, flanked by soldiers armed with rifles. Of course Broom hadn't been alone.
You, said the well mother, her face red with rage. How dare you wear the attire of a spring maiden? Where are the prisoners? Where is Commander Broom?
Gone, Nina lied. Beyond your reach.
Seize her, said the well mother, but Nina was already raising her hands.
I wouldn't, Nina said, and the soldiers hesitated, confused. Around her, she felt the cold tide of the river, eddying in deep pools. The graves of the unnamed and abandoned, buried without ceremony, women and girls brought here in secret who had suffered and died and been left to the dark, with no one to mourn them.
Come to me, Nina commanded.
She's just one girl, snapped the well mother. What kind of cowards are you?
Not just one girl, said Nina. The whispering rose in her, Fjordan women. Fjordan girls crying for justice, screaming in the silence of the earth. She opened her mouth and let them speak.
I am Petra Toft.
The words came from Nina's lips, but she did not recognize her own voice.
You cut me open and took the child from my womb. You let me bleed to death as I pleaded for help.
I am Siv Engman. I told you I had miscarried, that I could not carry a child to term. But you made me conceive again and again. I held each stillborn in my arms. I gave each one of them a name.
I am Eleanor Berglund. I was your student, placed in your care. I trusted you,
I called you well, Mother. I begged for your mercy when you discovered my powers. I died begging for another dose.
What is this?
Said the Well Mother, her hands clasped against her heart. She was shaking, her eyes wide as moons. Woman after woman, girl after girl, they spoke their names and Nina called them on. Come to me. Up through the earth, clawing through the soil they came, a mass of rotting limbs and broken bones, and some of them crawled. The doors to the ward slammed open, and the dead poured through. They moved with impossible speed, silent horrors, snatching the rifles from the Fjerdan soldiers even as they tried to open fire. Some were nearly whole. Others were nothing but bones and rags. The Well Mother backed away, her face a mask of terror. She stumbled on her pinafore and fell to the stone floor. An infant pulled itself toward her on all fours. Its chubby limbs were still intact, despite its blue lips and vacant eyes. The dead had made quick work of the guards, who lay bleeding in silent heaps. Now they advanced on the Well Mother. Nina turned to go.
Don't leave me,
the Well Mother begged as the baby seized hold of her skirts. I told you I would pray for you, said Nina as she closed the door and issued her final command to her soldiers.
Give her the mercy she deserves.
Nina turned her back on the Well Mother's screams.
Go, commanded Nina, as she clambered into the back of the wagon. The time for subtlety had passed. They burst through the eastern entrance and onto the road. When Nina turned to look, she expected to see the guards raising their rifles to fire at them. Instead, she saw two bloodied bodies in the snow, and a trail of paw prints leading into the trees.
Trassel. Her mind said she was a fool to think so, but her heart knew better. Now she understood why he'd never taken the food she'd left out. Matthias's wolf liked to hunt his prey. From somewhere up the mountain, she heard a long, mournful howl, and then a chorus of replies echoing over the valley. The gray wolves he had saved? Maybe Trassel would have to stay alone no longer. Maybe he'd finally said his goodbyes, too. Leonie was staring at Nina as they sped away from the factory. She had a baby clutched in her arms.
Remind me to never make you mad, Zenek, she said over the rattling of the cartwheels.
Nina shrugged.
Just don't do it by a graveyard.
What's happening?
Asked one of the girls drowsily.
Nothing, said Nina. Close your eyes. Rest. You'll get another dose soon.
A moment later, the air filled with the clamor of bells. Someone at the factory had sounded the alarm. There was no way they were going to make it through the checkpoint, but they couldn't stop now. They careened down the hill. Broom lay beneath a blanket, his body rolling this way and that as the cart jounced over a ditch. Nina leaned forward and pulled on Hannah's jacket to get her attention.
Slow down, she shouted. We can't look like we're running.
Hannah pulled back on the reins and glanced over her shoulder at Nina.
What are you?
She didn't sound scared, just angry.
Nothing good, said Nina, and sank back to her seat in the wagon.
Explanations and apologies would have to wait.
The wagon slowed and she peered through the slats. They were coming up on the checkpoint. She had known the timing had to be right, and now...
Halt!
The wagon rolled to a stop. Through the slats, Nina saw a group of Fjerdan soldiers, rifles at the ready. Behind them, a little farther down the hill, a long line of men and boys were headed to the fishery to work. They carried their lunch pails and chatted in easy conversation, barely sparing a glance for the guards or the wagon.
We are operating under orders from Commander Broom, said Hannah gruffly. Let us through.
You will stand down or you will be shot.
We're transporting...
Commander Broom came through here nearly an hour ago. He said no one was to pass without his direct say-so.
He turned to another guard and said,
Send someone up to the factory to find out what's going on.
Then he disappeared from view. A moment later, the doors to the cart swung open.
Jail in all his glory,
the soldier said, as the early morning light fell on the women packed into the wagon.
Seize the drivers and get these prisoners back up the mountain.
The baby in Leonie's arms began to wail.
Chapter 32 Zoya. Zoya did not scream. She stifled her panic as the sap rose over her ribcage and ceased her pounding on the golden sphere. She could not comprehend what she was seeing. 3 years ago, she had watched the Darkling's body burn to ash. She had whispered her aunt's name as he had vanished in the heat of Inferni flames beside the body of Sancta Alina. But it had not been Alina Starkov who lay on that pyre. Only a girl tailored to look like her. Had the Darkling supporters used the same trick? She did not understand the extent of what Elisaveta intended. Only that Nikolai would not live through it, and that Yori had betrayed them, the pious little wart. You always knew what he was, she scolded herself. You knew at which altar he chose to worship. But she had ignored him, dismissed him, because she had never truly seen him as a threat, and maybe because she hadn't wanted to see her own foolish idealism reflected in his fervent eyes. She watched Yori approach the shadow creature that hovered like a strange ghost in front of Nikolai. She had sensed the Darkling's presence that night in the bell tower. But she hadn't wanted to believe he could return. Blind, naive, selfish. Zoya held her breath as Yori reached for the glowing thorn. But suddenly the monster was attacking the monk. She looked at Nikolai's body splayed against the thornwood, like an insect pinned to a page. His eyes were closed. Could he be controlling the creature? There was no time to think on it. Zoya had tried to batter the sphere with the power of the storm to no avail. Now she focused on the sap that made up its walls, sensing the small parts that comprised it, the way its matter was formed. She was no tide maker. Before Joris, this would have been beyond her. But now? Are we not all things? She concentrated on forcing those tiny particles to vibrate faster, raising the temperature of the sap, disrupting the structure of the sphere. Sweat poured from her brow as the heat rose and she feared she'd cook in her own skin. In a single moment, the sphere's structure gave way. Zoya cast the scalding liquid away on a gust of air before it could burn her skin, and then she was running, letting the wind carry her over the sands to the palace.
What are you running to, little witch?
To Juris, to help. But what if the dragon already knew what Elisaveta intended? What if he was watching her from his black spire even now and laughing at her naivete? The wind faltered. Zoya's steps slowed. She gazed up at the black rock. How long could Nikolai use the monster's form to keep Yuri and the saint at bay? Was Zoya racing toward an ally? Or walking into a trap, squandering valuable time? Another betrayal. She wasn't sure she could bear it, but she would have to. She wasn't powerful enough to face Elisaveta on her own. She needed the dragon's wrath. There was no time to trouble with the palace's winding passages, and she doubted she could find her way. Instead, she let the storm lob her up, high into the sky in the mouth of Juris's cavern. The room was empty. The fire in the grate had gone out. That was when she saw the body. Joris lay on the floor in his human form, his broadsword discarded next to him. The gleam of his black scale armor seemed dull in the flat twilight. Joris, she cried. She slid to her knees beside him. He opened his eyes. They flickered silver, the pupils slitting.
That Elisaveta,
he said on a wheezing gasp.
Such an actress.
What happened? What did she do to you? He released a sound that might have been a laugh or a moan.
She offered me wine. After hundreds of years, honeymead made from fruit born of her vines, she said she had been saving it. It was sweet, but it was not wine.
She looked at his charred lips, his blackened tongue, and understood. It was fuel.
Only our own power can destroy us. My flames burned me from the inside.
No, Zoya said. No! Her heart was too full of loss. I'll get Grigori, he can heal you.
It's too late.
Jura seized her wrist with surprising force.
Listen to me. We thought we had convinced Elisaveta to give up her power. But that was never her intent. If she breaks free of the bounds of the fold, nothing will be able to control her. You must stop her.
How? Zoya pleaded.
You know what you must do, Zoya. Wear my bones.
She recoiled, but he did not release his grip.
Kill me. Take my scales.
Zoya shook her head. All she could think of was her aunt's resolute face. Zoya had been responsible for her death. She could have stopped the Darkling if she'd looked closer, if she'd understood, if she hadn't been consumed by her own ambition.
He doesn't get to take you from me, too.
I am not your aunt,
Joris growled.
I am your teacher. You were an able student. Prove to me that you are a great one.
She could not do it. You said it was a corruption.
Only if you give nothing of yourself in return.
The truth of that hit her, and Zoya knew she was afraid.
A little faith, Zoya. That is all this requires.
A bitter laugh escaped her. I don't have it.
There is no end to the power you may obtain. The making at the heart of the world has no limit. It does not weaken. It does not tire, but you must go to meet it.
What if I get it wrong all over again? What if she failed Joris as she had failed the others? Her life was crowded with too many ghosts.
Stop punishing yourself for being someone with a heart. You cannot protect yourself from suffering. To live is to grieve. You are not protecting yourself by shutting yourself off from the world. You are limiting yourself, just as you did with your training.
Please, Zoya said. She was the thing she'd always feared becoming. A lost girl, helpless, being led up the aisle of the chapel in Pachina.
Don't leave me. Not you too.
He nudged his broadsword with one hand.
Zoya of the lost city. Zoya of the garden. Zoya bleeding in the snow. You are strong enough to survive the fall.
Joris released a cry that began as a scream and became a roar as his body shifted from man to dragon, bones cracking, scales widening, until each was nearly the size of her palm. He enfolded her in his wings so gently.
Now, Zoya, I can hold on no longer.
Zoya released a sob. To live is to grieve. She was a lost girl. And a general, too. She hefted the broadsword in her hands, and with the power of the storm in her palms, drove the blade into his heart. At the same instant, Zoya felt the dragon's claws pierce her chest. She cried out, the pain like the fork of a lightning bolt splitting her open. She felt her blood soaking the silk against her body. A sacrifice. Joris released a heavy sigh and shut his glowing eyes. Zoya pressed her face to his scales, listening to the heavy thud of his heart, of her own. Was this death, then? She wept for them both as the rhythm began to slow. A moment passed. An age. Joris's claws retracted. She could hear only one heartbeat now, and it was her own. Zoya felt no pain. When she looked down, she saw her kefta was torn, but the blood flowed no longer. She touched her fingers to her skin. The wounds Joris had made had already healed. There was no time for mourning, not if Joris's sacrifice was to mean something, not if she had any hope of saving Nikolai and stopping Elisaveta. Zoya would have her revenge. She would save her king. She grabbed a dagger from the wall. Before her tears could begin anew, she scraped the scales from the ridge that ran over Joris's back. But what was she to do now? She wasn't a fabricator. That was Elisaveta's gift.
Are we not all things? Zoya had broken the boundaries within her order. But did she dare challenge the limits of the orders themselves?
Anything worth doing always starts as a bad idea.
Nikolai's words. Terrible advice, but perhaps it was time to heed it. She focused on the scales in her hand, sensed their edges, the particles that comprised them. It felt alien and wrong, and she knew instantly that this work would never be natural to her, but in this moment her meager skill would have to be enough. Zoya let the scales guide her. She could feel the shape they wanted to take, could see it burning clearly in her mind like a black wheel. No. A crown. Joris, pushy to the last. She shoved the image aside and forced the scales to form two cuffs around her wrists instead. As soon as the scales touched, sealing the bond, she felt Joris's strength flow through her, but this was different than it had been with the tiger.
Open the door.
She could feel his past, the eons both he and the dragon had lived flooding through her, threatening to overwhelm the short speck of her life.
Take it then, she told him.
I am strong enough to survive the fall. She felt Juris's restraint, felt him draw back, protecting her and guiding her as he had done over the past weeks, as he always would. The dragon was with her, and they would fight. Chapter 33. Nina. Over the guard's shoulder, Nina saw the fishermen turn their heads toward the sound of a crying baby. Hurriedly, the guard tried to slam shut the doors. Help! Cried Nina. Help us!
What's going on over there? Said one of the men.
Bless Fierda and its belief in helpless girls. They were taught from a young age to protect the weak, particularly women. That kindness didn't usually extend to Grisha, but the dead had spoken, and Nina intended to let them keep speaking. Another baby began to cry. That's it, kid, Nina whispered. Do your thing. Now the fishermen were moving up the side of the hill toward the checkpoint.
This is none of your concern,
said the guard, finally succeeding in closing the wagon doors.
What do you have in there?
A voice asked. Nina peered through the slats. Hanna and Adric had been yanked from the wagon and were flanked by armed men. The crowd of locals around the cart was growing.
Just a shipment for the factory, said the guard.
So why is the wagon headed down the mountain?
Get this wagon turned around and get going,
the guard growled to the soldiers now perched in the driver's seat. The reins snapped and the horses took a few tentative steps forward, but the fishermen had moved into the road, blocking the wagon's path.
Show us what's in the wagon,
said a large man in a red cap. Another stepped forward, hands spread in an open, reasonable gesture.
We can hear babies crying.
Why are you trying to take them to the munitions factory? I made it clear that it's none of your concern. We do not answer to you, and if you insist on interfering with the business of the Fjerdan military, we are authorized to use force.
A new voice spoke from somewhere Nina couldn't see.
Are you really going to open fire on these men?
Nina moved to the other side of the wagon and saw more of the townspeople had gathered, drawn by the commotion at the checkpoint.
Why wouldn't they? Said a woman. They already poisoned our river.
Be silent, hissed a soldier.
She's right,
said the tavern owner Nina recognized from their first day in town.
Killed that girl up at the convent. Killed Garrett's cattle.
You want to shoot us? Go ahead, said someone. I don't think you have enough bullets for us all.
Stay back, cried the guard, but Nina heard no gunfire. A moment later, the wagon doors were pried open once again.
What is this?
Said the man in the red cap.
Who are these women? What's wrong with them?
They're sick, said the guard. They've been quarantined for their own good.
There's no disease, said Nina from the shadows of the cart. The soldiers have been experimenting on these girls.
But they're all... Are they all pregnant?
Nina let the silence hang, felt the mood of the crowd shift from suspicion to outright anger.
You're from the convent?
The man asked, and Nina nodded. Let this miserable pinafore and these awful blonde braids lend her a bit of credibility.
These prisoners are not women, sputtered the guard.